Morning to and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is May 16th, 2024. The argument before us at this time is in case number 823-1476, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Davion Liddell Beasley Appellant. Counsel, this argument is being recorded by Zoom, but only an audio recording will be posted later on the public website, our public website. No other recordings are permitted. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. And at the start of those arguments, please state your name and the party that you represent for the record. Counsel for appellant, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The clock is visible to both, I hope. And counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Kelly, and I'm representing the appellant, Davion Beasley. This case brings before this court a challenge to the constitutionality as to the issuance and execution of two search warrants. The first warrant is a tracking warrant. The second warrant was a warrant to search the vehicle and the person of my client. Both of these warrants, the analysis as to both of these warrants, very similar. Appellant relies heavily upon the Sudo case from the Minnesota Supreme Court. There are also a lot of similarities to Illinois v. Gates from the U.S. Supreme Court. The first warrant, which is the tracking warrant application, I can tell the court that my addendum to my brief identifies the particular items in that addendum. I apologize that that addendum is not paginated, if you will, and we are going to invite the court to direct us to file a supplemental addendum if the court thinks that's beneficial. But the
Mr. Kelly, can I ask you about that first warrant? One of your points that you emphasize, well, a couple of things that regarding the informants, but we've got the two different informants, and one of your main concerns about the CI is the staleness, some information going back to 2018, 2017. But my question is this, even if we accept that and exclude that, the confidential reliable informant, so we presume reliability, did provide information involving your client specifically, including the Percocet communication, requesting if he knew of anybody that might be, or the CRI knew anybody that would want to purchase, but then also made the statement that he travels to Minneapolis, St. Paul area, MSP, back to Bemidji to pick up drugs. And then you got the corroboration. But my question, that's pretty significant evidence, isn't it? Does your argument boil down to, if we agree that both CIs are not informative, that you might have a stronger case, but if we disagree, at least as to the CRI, that your argument is less strong? Would that be a fair statement?
So I think that my argument focuses in, once again, reasonableness, right? The touchstone of the Fourth Amendment. So when the police get information that someone is asking a CRI, if they know anyone who's interested in buying some drugs, does that automatically trigger a tracking warrant? Even if the averment is, and we don't know exactly, there's no basis for the CRI saying that my client goes to and from the cities to get drugs. He doesn't say, Beasley told me that he goes to get drugs in Minneapolis. Both applications repeat a lot of stale, passive voice.
But Mr. Kelly, isn't the staleness? I was accepting that for my question. It will presume the CI, isn't it? It's only the CI information and that is arguably stale because it goes back to 2017, 2018, whereas the other information is 2021, including the separate corroboration, the police officer who observed a transaction, I think hand-to-hand was the phrase between your client and Arcadio Rainey and so forth. So don't we have to look not at just one particular fact, but at the totalities, do we not?
We do. And I understand that sometimes when you're drafting a warrant application, you can get very passive. But to say CRI advised that Beasley had been transporting controlled substances to Bemidji from the Minneapolis area since Beasley was released from, what did he, Beasley say that? Did he go with Beasley? Where does this come from?
Well, I agree with you that there's not an express basis of knowledge stated there. But then, I mean, isn't this a totality of the circumstances analysis at the end of the day? And don't we have some, reference to testimony or information provided that the CRI gave that did reflect a basis of knowledge? I spoke with Mr. Beasley. But then we have corroborative evidence about where police, in fact, saw him. They saw him in Bemidji. They saw a hand-to-hand transaction. They saw a Facebook post. They saw photos. I mean, why isn't that corroborative evidence coupled with a CRI providing information sufficient to issue a warrant?
So once again, I'm going to try for purposes of brevity to address both applications because some of these averments are obviously duplicated. But if you look on page 7 of addendum 3, which is the second application, it indicates that the affiant observed a hand-to-hand transaction between Arcadio Rainey and a male through the passenger side. That's on the second, is the first full paragraph. So I understand that when you read this in totality, it's easy to kind of, you still have to take it apart bit by bit and then look at it again. And each, there's problems with almost every averment. And when you look at the specific averments, once again, that there was some sale in the driveway at an address in Bemidji, 903 Bemidji Avenue North. Well, then you look further down the application, that's Arcadio Rainey's residence. So when you put it all together, totality.
Right. But the averment, I'm looking right on November 16th, 2021, your client was contacted by another police officer who observed Demetria Carter Rainey and Mr. Beasley conduct a hand-to-hand transaction at that residence.
I think that that is, first off, secondhand from the other officer. Okay, let's go collective knowledge. Then let's talk about how that's even possible. There's two guys are handing something off. That's just these guys. I saw them both. There was some hand-to-hand transaction. And by the way, no claim of any cash being seen, no claim of any drugs being seen.
I thought there's a reference to controlled substances located in the vehicle.
Well, they stopped. Yeah. Okay. So they stopped the vehicle. Now, there's no claim by the person that they talked to when they stopped the vehicle, I got drugs from those guys. There's no claim that even that wasn't the seller and Arcadio Rainey's buying a little bit of marijuana. I mean, we just don't know what it shows. So once again, do you get the tracking warrant? And let's concede the tracking warrant. I'm certainly making my arguments, but let's move on because I think that the more unreasonable warrant is the second one. And the more outrageous
Mr. Kelly, Mr. Kelly, I'm sorry, just before you get there, one question first on the tracking warrant. What role does the statute which authorizes the tracking warrant, which provides for either crimes that have occurred or, which seems to fit here better, crimes that might occur? What does that play into our normal probable cause analysis, constitutional analysis of a search warrant, or does it have any impact whatsoever?
I would say it doesn't have that the Fourth Amendment, Article 1, Section 10, and this court's precedent clearly trump that statute. You can't say in a statute that we're going to require less than probable cause to issue a tracking warrant.
I guess that wasn't my question. That certainly, I think, has been established. My question is, it does authorize tracking, though, does it not, to consider crimes as long as there's probable cause to believe crimes are about to occur?
Right. And that the information that you're seeking is going to discover evidence of a crime, right? A probability, or that it's reasonable for a person to suspect that it will. So we're talking about a warrant application that's, you know, the breadth of which is addressed by Jones v. United States and Riley. I mean, there's a lot of concern about the breadth of this kind of a warrant. Is it really reasonable to say, I want to follow somebody because I'm getting intel? I don't want to have to do all the work I'd normally have to do as an investigator. So what I want is something that's going to track this person 24/7 for 90 days. Is that reasonable based on what we have here? So to answer your question, I think that the statute, I think I already have answered your question. I don't think the statute certainly provides that this makes it, you know, you can go with less than PC. And I think the court's agreeing with me, but then you get to the more outrageous warrant, where because of the tracking, they know our Coda Rainey is going to and from Twin Cities, and there's some movement going on. Well, this is between Thanksgiving and Christmas. There's certainly there's no information that this tracking warrant establishes that they are going to a known drug house. They're going to North Minneapolis, as if that means there's got to be a crime, right? They're coming from North Minneapolis. I mean, it doesn't say that we connected the dots with other known sources, and they're following these people 24/7 into their homes. Now, the travel goes north. Very important for this court to note in application number 2 as to the tracking warrant. I'm sorry, as to the search of the vehicle, that the CRI indicates in application number 2 on page 4 that our Ricardo Rainey will hide controlled substances on his body in his genital area when he's transporting controlled substances. And the applicant and the court transpose that averment to my client. And they get a search warrant in execution, which subjects my client to a felony stop, handcuff, transport to the jail, and
probable cause, or do you have a second separate argument that even if it does, it was illegal to arrest him and bring him to the sheriff's office? And if you do, what legal authority would that latter argument be based upon? Or is it all woven into one? If you understand my question, is it really a single issue and it has to do with probable cause and the search warrant?
I can confess that as I got deeper and deeper into my arguments, I certainly went down some rabbit holes, and I'm hoping that I'm presenting my case well. The search of my client was challenged as to being insufficient averments in the application in defendant's position 1D in the motion to suppress, amended motion to suppress, dated October 22nd, 2022. And then I also indicated that the search was without a warrant or an exception to the warrant requirement. So then in my memo, I argued that reasonableness of the de facto arrest and indicated that when you look at the warrant itself, it says you can use this device to search the defendant. Once again, going back to the averment, there's no claim that my client crotches these drugs, but somehow that's what the warrant says you can search. Keep in mind, when you look at the transcript of the testimony, the car that's stopped, no drugs in the car, no odor, no impairment, nothing found from the pat frisk, weapons or drugs. So they've executed the warrant to search the car that they obtained as a result of the tracking order and the averments, and they find nothing. But now they take my client to the jail. They book him in, and they use this device. Nowhere in that warrant will you see that it says you may transport the defendant to the jail. It just says that you can use this device to search the defendant. So I would argue that he was searched with that device in the jail without a warrant, because it did not authorize his transport to the jail. It just says you can use this device. Whether that device can be carried in the hand, or it needs to be, once again, you need to go to the jail to do it. The application didn't specify, and the particularly the warrant didn't authorize that transport. And this is where we get back to these big picture items: totality of the circumstances, reasonableness. Let's say everything up to the point of the traffic stop.
And counsel, let me just note that your time has run out, although you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you want to just make your quick last point, if you have one.
If we get to the stop of the car as being constitutional, I still win. Because when he gets taken to the jail and booked in and searched, it's beyond the scope of that warrant. That's why I argued it was warrantless in my motion and my memo. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. I was just looking. Okay. So is that let me just follow up with you for 1 second, Mr. Kelly. Do you make the warrantless argument in your brief on appeal?
I argued the reasonableness
okay.
of that conduct.
Okay.
I'll have to look in the memo specifically. I know that it was once again brought up to the district court as well.
Gotcha. Okay. Yep. I see. All right. Thank you, counsel, for respondent.
Good morning. Mike Malin for the state of Minnesota respondent. May it please the court. I don't want to be very long-winded. From the state's perspective, we do have two search warrants. And I think that ultimately the analysis really is probable cause, and whether or not those search warrants were based on probable cause. As the court's aware, one of the things that the appellate court reviews, the main thing I would say is whether the issuing judge had a substantial basis for concluding that probable cause existed. In my brief, I argue that substantial basis does exist for concluding that probable cause exists. Beyond that, Your Honors, I think I would just rather ask any questions that the court may have specifically on any of those issues.
Mr. Malin, since we kind of left off on what you describe in your brief as a third issue, and I was asking Mr. Kelly about how do you respond to that point that in the warrant itself that there's no direction to transport Mr. Beasley to the jail in order to use the scanner. It does reference the scanner, of course, and I think there's referencing that in the application. I was just looking where the officer referenced that it's used when individuals are booked, but I didn't see a specific request that he be transported. Is that important? Does it exist? And/or is it important if it does not? And why not if it's not important?
Thank you, Judge. So obviously we're talking about something that happens on the road. That's where the traffic stop occurs. And the Soter body scanner is a fairly large piece of equipment that is housed in the jail. It's not a transportable item to my knowledge. And so I think that there's, first of all, a practical aspect to this, that in order to get the individual to that scanner, he has to be transported. I suspect it's similar to a DWI investigation. You know, the DMT machine is not a portable unit. There's a search warrant for a breath sample. I don't know if that search warrant specifically authorizes the individual's transportation, but of course we all expect that to be the case. I don't think that a search.
But we also have people under arrest in that scenario, right? And I'm confused by the significance, if any, of the fact that some of the officers on the scene says you're under arrest. Does that make any difference from a constitutional perspective?
Your Honor, from my perspective, it does not. There was a search warrant that authorized that search. I don't know if this might be beyond the scope of the question, but this type of search, in my mind, is a lot less onerous and a lot less embarrassing than simply strip searching the individual, which again would have to be done in a private setting and would require transportation of the individual to a different site. It's not something that we're going to do on the roadside. And so I don't think that comes into play from my perspective.
So, Councilman, we're looking at the second warrant authorizing the search of the person in the motor vehicle. I mean, it happened to be that they actually stopped the vehicle with Mr. Beasley in it, but I suppose also could have come into town, parked, and been in a store. And I guess that warrant would have authorized then the search of his person, correct? And to bring him to the station to utilize the scanning technology. Is that correct?
Correct.
And what is the, and so the probable cause to believe that he would have drugs on his person, is the practice of his colleague necessary element of that in terms of where drugs are hidden? What is the probable cause that Mr. Busey would have drugs on his person, or is probably would have drugs on his person?
Thank you, Judge. So when we look at that second search warrant, we do see that it includes information regarding general evidence of transporting of narcotics. And included in that rationale, Judge, or that the totality of that would be that this individual who's been named several times is sort of a partner to Mr. Beasley. They've been seen numerous times. They've been seen conducting hand-to-hand transaction. I think that it would be logical that the practices would be similar between the two in sort of a common enterprise. And so I think that it is important consideration where he is known to hide controlled substances. I think that's a logical and a legitimate consideration for where D'Avion might also hide controlled substances.
Now, Mr. Malin, and I know she muted yourself, so you'll have to unmute if you wish to be heard in a moment and answer my question. The phrase anticipatory warrant was used, I think, both in the application, but the district court judge did, and then also triggering event. I'm not familiar, at least in this context, of those phrases. Are those legal phrases, or are they simply jargon that is used in the industry? And I don't know if that's directly relevant to what we're doing, although, you know, when you got tracking and it talks about the statute of crime that's about to be committed, and I assume that has something to do with anticipatory, but can you explain that to me, those phrases, please?
That's a really good question, Judge. I do see that they are in quotations, the triggering event, and they've described those as when the task force is able to basically come into contact with or, make contact with the appellant, whether or not those are industry phrases or I can't answer that question, Judge. That's the way that they're phrased certainly seems to indicate that they have more meaning than simply in your common parlance.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I'm a bit comforted because I hadn't seen it. But well, let me ask this then. Is the concept of a triggering event, was it more to demonstrate that they're, in fact, as in the past, coming into Beltrami County in the Bemidji area? Or could they have arrested stop the car prior to coming, because a task force usually involves multiple counties, and as long as they're heading north, have stopped them. Is that important in this case?
I agree, Judge. And as the court indicated, these typically involve BCA agents. Sometimes the task force is comprised of members of other law enforcement from different counties. Specifically in this warrant, they do indicate that, you know, it was the arrival into Beltrami County. I'm not sure why that was designated so. I think that the court is correct that it could have taken place anytime along that route. Well, you know, I think I might walk that back, Judge, because I think that the real crux of the investigation was the fact that the belief that appellant was transporting narcotics to the Beltrami County, to Bemidji. And so I think that that is probably important in that respect. But other than, I think that's probably the most significance to that position.
And am I correct that and Mr. Kelly makes this point, there was only one time out of those series of trips that that the co-defendant, I'll call him co-defendant, I think that's a fair description here, was traveling on his own, but only once was Mr. Beasley traveling with him. And that's what led then to requesting this warrant, search warrant, stop and search and scan that we're talking about. Is that correct?
Judge, I'd have to really comb through it to see if there was only one identified trip with the pair. I do want to say that I think there was mention of other times that they were together, including that hand-to-hand transaction. And that might be the one that Your Honor is referencing. That might be in addition to that one trip. But I would have to look at that a little bit closer to see if there was a singular established trip or multiple with the pair.
And counsel, do you have more of your argument, or it looks like our questions have sort of stopped?
That's pretty much all I have, Your Honor. I would say that touching on a few of the things that Mr. Kelly indicated, particularly as it relates to the North Minneapolis reference, I think it's a little bit more involved than that. I think that there is information as it relates to gang activity, as well as known locations of gang members and those associations too. I don't think it was as simple as this particular suburb. I think it was a little bit more involved than that. So I guess I would just touch up on that. I think that's all I have.
Great, thank you very much. And Counsel for Appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I will start with the anticipatory warrants. Not cited in my brief is United States v. Grubbs, G-R-U-B-B-S. And that case discusses triggering events. There are a number of anticipatory warrants that I saw once I started going down that trail. And the anticipatory warrant cases, Your Honor, I can tell the court, almost exclusively relate to the delivery of a package which has been intercepted, is known to contain a controlled substance. And then the police want to go into a house immediately after delivering that package. So the anticipatory warrant is sought. The triggering event is the receipt of the package. And what's interesting about that for this court, when you look at totality of the circumstances and reasonableness, this is really, really far from that, right? I mean, in that circumstance, what the police are saying is by the time when we drop off that package, we're going to know there's evidence of a crime inside that house. We just dropped it off. And when the defendant takes it, we get to go in. So that's where they're always That's the only place I've seen them used. I've never seen them used in this fashion. Now, Illinois v. Gates is somewhat of an, is somewhat factually interesting for this court. It actually goes against appellant's argument, but the details of that travel, when you look at Illinois v. Gates and then probable cause, there are some similarities and there's a lot of distinguishing points. So while some of the rules regarding somewhat of the reasonable suspicion to be determined from travel, right? So going to Florida, spending 12 hours and then driving home to Illinois, that was seen as being highly suspicious, along with the informant information, which was that these individuals had the drugs, the Gates had the individuals, had the drugs in there.
Is it possible, Mr. Kelly, and I appreciate your explanation of those phrases, that that was just inappropriately used in this case? In other words, that this is not an anticipatory search warrant. The state might argue that there was probable cause. They do argue there was probable cause to believe he would be possessing drugs from that trip. And of course, as it turned out, that he was. But my
I think both of those are true, Your Honor. I mean, it's like this is an anticipatory warrant. The triggering event was him crossing the border into Beltrami County. And that's exactly where the stop occurred, was on the border.
So let me ask this, getting back then to well, I'll call it your 2A issue, and it was the third issue in the respondent's brief. I'm looking at the second application for search, the search warrant, and the applicant says authority to utilize Beltrami County Jail's SOTR body scanner to assist in the search of persons. Are you arguing that that's insufficient, that that it had to go on and the judge would have had to add this in the actual warrant part and to transport if necessary to do it? And if so, what legal authority would you have that that's not sufficient to allow it to be done as it was done in this case?
Well, certainly the averments are not the court order. I understand that is, you correctly pointed to that point in the application where they talk about wanting to take him to the jail. But back to the comments of the court regarding, you know, bringing somebody back to the station house when you've got all the case law that supports impaired driving, exigency, bringing them back to us. They're under arrest at that point in time due to the conduct. If they would have found drugs in my client's pocket out on the road, they would have been justified in bringing him to the jail. And then going forward, as far as that entire arrest, right? So the warrant itself authorizes the conduct. The averments are not the authorization from the court. That would be my argument.
But the warrant, the warrant says that your client can be searched, just a broad statement that he can be searched. And then also says authority to utilize Beltrami County Jail's SOTR body scanner. I mean, isn't it implicit that they get him there somehow to use that scanner?
I think it's fair to read it that way. I don't think that's reasonable. And I'll go back to this nexus argument. You look at nexus, which is discussed in Kahn and Pseudo. What is the nexus to my client's underwear? That you have a reasonable, do you have really have a reasonable probability that drugs are going to be found in his underwear? I don't think you can make that leap based upon the totality of the circumstances that we have here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing. Thank you for your arguments. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out within the statutory time period. Have a good day.